Yeah, right.
Well, I don't see our...
Well, he's been back
in the last to be here.
How are you?
I was with him. Next thing I knew, good morning.
Next thing I knew, he was in the...
How are you? Again? Harrison Smith from Oregon. How are you? Good to see you again.
Yeah, I did.
No, we're missing here.
Yeah,
right, you need
it. Yes, I understand it.
All right.
Sam, how are you?
Oh, yeah, nice to see you. See what happened to us at
appropriations?
That's good.
People are lunatic.
See, but you guys got to get your top brass to push the president. I mean, this is a president that ought to be, you know, I'm talking about the cuts we got out of appropriations. They're just crazy. And I think what you got to do is you got to have your top guy go to the president.
Oh, well.
Because this is a president sensitive to what the Coast Guard does, unlike a lot of people. And, you know, just get him to tell the Secretary of Transportation to veto the bill if it doesn't, you know, come to an increase in funds.
Mike said I should go to the
Yeah, absolutely.
We started, the call started
But we're doing that from the outside, too.
And it hasn't,
No, we'll keep pushing from our side, don't worry.
Appreciate it.
Nice to see you.
How you doing?
So these guys want to...
Anywhere, yeah.
I think Danielle was planning on coming too. That's what he's doing. Well, he's just
a couple of words.
What do you have for us?
Dan is Don. Don's on his way, or okay. So we just go ahead and go. The subcommittee on water power and offshore energy resources will come to order. The purpose of this morning's hearing is to conduct an oversight hearing on the status of the Exxon Alaska oil spill cleanup. It is the intent of the chair that we will take testimony from the three witnesses as a panel, and then we will open it up for questions from members of the committee. And I would ask if any members of the committee have any opening statements that they would like to make prior to the testimony. Anyone? If I might, we will swear the witnesses as we have in the previous hearings on this subject, and my understanding is each of the witnesses have been informed of this prior to that. Let me say that it's the practice of this subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it at investigative hearings. Do you have any objections to being sworn? None of the witnesses do. If you would stand, raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. In order to inform you of your rights as witness before the committee and limitations and the authority of the subcommittee, the rules of the House of Representatives and the committee are on the table in front of you, and both sets of rules have been previously been provided to you. You're advised of your right to counsel. The role of counsel would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel? Thank you very much. Stevens, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me say, I know some of you have supporting documents, or at least there was some discussion of that. Your entire statements will be placed in the record in their entirety, and any documentations or supporting evidence that you want to make part of this this hearing will be placed also in the record of this hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bill Stevens, president of Exxon Company USA, and as you noted, I have submitted written testimony and a supplemental statement along with a videotape for the record. Mr. Chairman, let me be very brief and clear in responding to the issues raised in the letter of invitation to testify before this subcommittee. The following is a statement by Exxon's chairman at the annual meeting of shareholders on May 18th of this year, and I quote, "Our objective is to complete the job by mid-September, and milestones have been established to measure our progress. In any event, we will return to the area in the spring of 1990 to reinspect the area to assure that the job has been properly done, and, if not, to put it right." End quote. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Exxon stands firmly behind that statement. Thank you.
Thank you. Admiral Lusk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to be here with you and with other distinguished members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, in accordance with the Clean Water Act and the National Contingency Plan that was put out pursuant to that act, the Coast Guard provides the pre-designated federal on-scene coordinators for pollution incidents which occur in the coastal zone. These on-scene coordinators have the authority to determine when and if a spill should be federalized, and to be the decision maker regarding spill cleanup. The Exxon Valdez spill in the built in Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and Texas have been a startling reminder of the need to be ready and to have adequate resources to respond. Early lessons learned from Valdez have resulted in many initiatives to reduce the likelihood of recurrence and to increase response capability. Thank you. We've initiated a thorough review of all port contingency plans in a number of areas which contribute to spill prevention, such as ship design, vessel manning and licensing, vessel traffic service systems and where they should be, pilotage, and inspection. They're all being carefully restudied. As an example of those efforts, the National Academy of Science has been asked to conduct a study on the role of double hulls and double bottoms in tank vessels. We look forward to that study being completed within a year. We're also assessing our research and development needs, Mr. Chairman. Certainly, we've gotten an awful lot in the past from research and development. We have not spent too many dollars on research and development in recent years, and we're trying to assess what our needs are in that area. And we're also assessing whether or not we should provide additional personnel and resources for our strike teams. Congress and the administration have proposed new laws to strengthen our ability to prevent and to clean up future oil spills. Secretary Skinner transmitted proposed legislation to Congress last month, which would improve the Coast Guard's ability to monitor the character and the fitness of those persons to whom we issue merchant mariners' documents and licenses. The administration has submitted a bill and strongly supports comprehensive oil spill liability and compensation legislation and ratification of the 1984 international protocols to the Civil Liability and Fund Conventions, which we've been seeking now for 5 years. In each of the last 10 years, Mr. Chairman, the Coast Guard has responded to an average of approximately 8,800 oil spills. The vast majority of the spills involved less than 10,000 gallons. They occurred in sheltered waters, and they were routinely cleaned up using conventional cleanup techniques. The Exxon Valdez spill is unique for two reasons. One, because of its remote location, and two, because of its enormity. It's approximately four times larger than our previous most significant spill. In Alaska, we're now in the most difficult and the most labor-intensive phase of shoreline cleanup. The Federal On-Scene Coordinator, Vice Admiral Robbins, and his staff are certainly providing very great resources, very great amount of expertise, along with a large number of federal and state employees. They're providing the direction and the monitoring for the continued Exxon cleanup. The Department of Defense continues to provide naval berthing facilities for berthing many of the shoreline cleanup crews. Navy skimmers and booms are still being deployed, and DOD continues to provide other support for the effort. Exxon has in excess of 3,400 shoreline cleanup personnel operating there today. These direct workers and Exxon support personnel together approximate 10,800 workers. In addition, there are more than 900 boats and more than 60 aircraft being operated by Exxon. I didn't mention the aircraft and the vessels being operated by DOD, other government agencies, and my own service. The skimming of free or surface oil in the water is nearly complete. Two types of shoreline cleanup are underway. The first involves manual procedures such as mechanical removal of congealed oil and oil debris, which leaves the natural shoreline relatively undisturbed. The second involves mechanical devices and other enhancement methods such as cold, warm and hot washing, removing oil material, and trenching. The Coast Guard Federal On-Scene Coordinator, working with EPA, NOAA, the state, and Exxon, continues to seek more innovative methods for shoreline cleanup. These include testing of chemical agents, tested and planned testing of various fertilizers that promote the growth of naturally occurring biological organisms which consume oil, and testing of hot water injection methods for treating subsurface oil. The Federal On-Scene Coordinator's goal is that all shoreline segments be treated before the expected onset of severe weather in September. By then, heavily and moderately oiled shoreline segments should be treated to a stable level. Lightly oiled segments should be fully treated. Plans are being developed to evaluate the effects of winter weather on any oil that may remain, and before next spring, an evaluation will be conducted to determine any work that's required. Mr. Chairman, much needs to be done to improve our nation's ability to prevent and to respond to oil spills. Since the existing statutory regime was complied with, and many believe that it has proven to be inadequate in the case of a huge spill such as the one we experienced in Valdez, I suggest that a need exists to change the applicable statute. The plethora of bills being discussed support my view that there's a need for legislation with industry-wide and nationwide application. Many of those bills do not have that industry-wide or nationwide application, sir. The Coast Guard looks forward to working with Congress in determining what best meets the nation's needs. We're willing to do more, Mr. Chairman. Well, I guess we always are. But we do plead that our service be provided with the resources it needs to fulfill any new responsibilities. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Kelso.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to join you today. It is particularly important to Alaskans that this committee continue its active interest in this spill and the response to the spill. I was in Kodiak on Monday and talked with a number of people who expressed their urgent feelings about the progress of the cleanup and the fact that in their area the spill is a continuing event. In fact, discussing with our field crew that had just come back from the west side of the island, they had identified new areas that had not previously been hit, that had been hit in during the last week with what they described as fresh moose, some of which may have actually been carried below the surface of the water for some distance because it was did not appear to be contaminated with debris. At any rate, the point of that is that this spill is not yet fully behind us, and for people in Kodiak, Cook Inlet communities, other communities in the Kodiak area and on the Kenai Peninsula, the pain of the event is hitting them still every day. The Kodiak fishermen have virtually lost the salmon season. The red salmon run, the sockeyes, is just about done, and that means that the money fish for the fishermen for this season is pretty much past. So we view this with great concern, and the interest of this committee gives the people who have been most directly affected some reassurance and a sense of support as well. Much work has yet to be done, both within the sound and outside the sound. Let me show you a photograph that was taken when I went to Green Island a few days ago. This is a photograph of a shoreline segment that had been treated. I requested a chance to go to a shoreline segment that had been most recently treated on Green Island, and this is what it looks like. The fluid that you see here is actually water. It's not oil, but the rocks are not naturally that color, and the shiny black stuff really is oil. It looks a lot like it did when the shoreline was first oiled with the crude oil, and this particular stretch was so slippery it was hard to stand up. Now, I show this not to suggest that Exxon is doing a bad job, but rather to show you that there's still work that needs to be done, even in areas that have been treated and are part of the mileage that is always listed as having been subject to the initial treatment, because the initial treatment is just the removal of the gross contamination. It does not result in a clean shoreline, and it wasn't intended to. It was intended to be a first pass. The people who are working on this, the Exxon folks who are out there on these shorelines, I think are just trying to do a good job, and I think they deserve credit for that. I feel the same way about the Coast Guard and our staff. But we have a long ways to go. We're making progress. We're not going to be done, in my view, by September 15th. But that simply means we need to make a commitment to continue the work until we have removed as much oil as can be expected to be removed. Thanks, Suzanne. What we're looking to Exxon to do at this point is pretty straightforward. We would like to see the effort outside of Prince William Sound beefed up.
Excuse me just for a second, but I think you're wanting people to either put the photograph down or move it back over here by the monitor. Thank you.
The effort outside of Prince William Sound needs to be beefed up. This is something that both the state and Admiral Yost have asked for in the past. There has been some increase in effort, but there is a long way to go, and the need to get the material off the shoreline, even though it isn't the same kind of contamination that you just saw in the photograph of Green Island, is very important, because as long as there's moose or tarballs coming ashore there, we have a problem for fishermen, not only this season, but in the future as well. So beefing up the effort outside of Prince William Sound is one thing. Second is to work as long as the weather and safety considerations allow. We recognize that there'll be a need to scale back the effort and to go into a winter operation. Alaskans certainly respect that, and safety is a primary consideration. We're just suggesting that in different parts of this spill area, winter comes at different times, and it may be possible to continue the work for a longer period in certain areas, and it should be done that way as long as it's reasonable to do so. Second, we'd like Exxon to join us in some specific tasks over the winter. We're not expecting them to field the kind of shoreline treatment that they've been fielding in Prince William Sound this summer, certainly not. But there are specific tasks, shoreline survey, mapping, monitoring of the movement of the spill, and very importantly, maintaining an emergency response capability in case oil starts to move either on its own or on vegetation or debris toward the areas we worked so hard this summer to protect. The three hatchery sites, Ishami Bay, for example, that the state, fishermen, and Exxon teamed up to, with the Coast Guard teamed up to make sure we're protected. And finally, and this really is perhaps the most important to us, is a commitment to continue the work. And by that, I mean committing to do the work identified by the state as well as by the Coast Guard. The areas in which the treatment have to be done are state lands, and the people who are most directly affected by the impact of the spill are residents of Alaska. So it's very important to us that our environmental standards be followed. We want to work cooperatively and reasonably with Exxon. We're committed to continue working through the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, but we want to be clear that state standards apply here and that Exxon will have an acceptable commitment, in our view, only if they're willing to do the work that the Coast Guard requires or the state requires. And we're eager to continue a cooperative relationship. Sometimes we get frustrated with that, but that has not shaken our resolve to continue working cooperatively to keep our sleeves rolled up and to get this job done right and do as much as we can to restore this area. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. General Lusk, let me ask you, what's the role of the Coast Guard going to be, both with, in a number of areas? One, with respect to the decisions on the demobilization of the cleanup effort, and two, what kind of work should be conducted over the winter, and three, the discussions about what takes place next spring. What is the Coast Guard's role in this? How do you perceive that?
The Coast Guard's role in a fashion, sir, is somewhat absolute. The statute indicates that the federal on-scene coordinator has the responsibility for the cleanup, but it does give him some guidance, as do the regulations that implemented that statute. Essentially, we have to make available to the chap who spilled it, to whom the statute gives the ultimate responsibility, the opportunity to clean it up himself. Certainly, we try to encourage that, but if he doesn't do it in a fashion that we consider to be adequate, then we assume the responsibility ourselves. Now, we have a mechanism, a rather well-structured mechanism that includes some 14 different agencies that provide input, that are members of a group that is established to advise the federal on-scene coordinator. I mentioned Vice Admiral Robbins happens to be the federal on-scene coordinator in Valdez. That group of individuals who are there to advise him include not only the environmental protection agencies and other federal agencies, but also include state representation. The good Admiral Robbins would and is discussing with Exxon now what their plans are relative to, and I'll take these things in order, relative to the demobilization, if that's the right word. Admiral Robbins has talked to their on-scene commander, Mr. Harrison, I believe, and Mr. Harrison is presenting sometime during early August with a proposed plan by Exxon for phasing down their winter operations. I spoke to Admiral Robbins within the last day or so, and as best I understand it, their communication has been very recent, and their communication is that Exxon is envisioning not a termination on the 15th of September, as has been suggested in some quarters, but Exxon is envisioning a taking out of very heavy equipment and the like that can't be used as weather comes in, and that they're talking in terms of a phase down that will accommodate the weather and the needs as are described by the federal on-scene coordinator. Now, in that regard, if Admiral Robbins is dissatisfied with that, if Admiral Robbins feels that Exxon has not provided for all that he feels necessary, then he would obviously urge them, along with the rest of his advisory group, to do more. Should they see fit not to, either in a certain area or during a period of time, for instance, then Admiral Robbins has the option of either totally or partially federalizing. And if he does that, as I indicated before, then the federal government assumes responsibility for that total or partial mobilization. In like fashion, it's Admiral Robbins' understanding that part of that phase-down proposal by Exxon will include an indication of where they're going to store equipment during the winter, the people that are going to be available, and I believe he remembered, and I don't have notes on this, but I believe he mentioned four different areas of Alaska, to provide any support during the winter should it be needed, and the relationships that the federal on-scene coordinator will have with Exxon during the winter. Now, here again, if something happens during the winter, and if Exxon is unable to respond or unwilling to respond, then the statute requires Admiral Robbins and his staff to appropriately respond, so that whatever the situation is will be accommodated. Come spring, there seems to be no disagreement anywhere that a review is going to be necessary, call it a survey, is going to be necessary in the spring. After that survey, and that survey is going to be accompanied, or there will be participation by a number of different scientific people, different disciplines, sir. After that, there will be discussions, once again, chaired by Admiral Robbins, regarding what's appropriate for further cleanup in the spring. I have absolutely no doubt that with so many members of the scientific community involved, that there are going to be disagreements about what should be done. I have no doubt but what we're going to find areas where someone says a certain stretch of shoreline should be cleaned, perhaps for cosmetic or other reasons, and where other scientists are going to be saying that the cleaning process itself will cause more environmental degradation than leaving the material on the rocks, for instance. But somehow or other, Admiral Robbins is going to have to sieve through that, is going to have to listen to the states and listen to his other advisors and make decisions. And those decisions will be his.
Mr. Kelso, are you involved in this process about the winter cleanup, these discussions that we're told are taking place?
I don't know which discussions Admiral Lusk is referring to, but I was involved in one discussion with Exxon staff and with Admiral Robbins. My understanding, though, of what Exxon is prepared to do is, first of all, to pull all of the equipment back to Anchorage, not to leave any of the equipment that's currently there in either Prince William Sound or the other areas, and that the personnel who would be available in the field would be just liaison personnel, would not be in a position to respond if there were a need for either emergency intervention or other steps to be taken. The reason that's a problem is that Anchorage by road is about 6 hours from Valdez. You cross two mountain ranges, and if your equipment for response is all located in Anchorage, it's not likely that you're going to have a very timely intervention. That's particularly important in an area such as Sawmill Bay Hatchery, where we already had a near miss earlier this summer in which oil got to within 1,000 feet of that hatchery, even though we've got it carefully boomed and have been working throughout the spring and summer to protect it. So our suggestion is simply that there be a reasonable field presence in the areas of the spill in order to make sure that that is dealt with. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, I think that the winter activity can provide the background necessary so you don't have to have a startup survey as a separate event in the spring. If we're surveying the shoreline during the winter months, we'll know where the distribution of that oil is, what the circumstances are, and can do the advanced planning so that no time is lost in the spring. That's the kind of approach that we're suggesting, and it seems to us reasonable to do that in an orderly way rather than waiting until spring and then having a large flurry of survey activity to decide what to do next.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens, what's your statement on what's going to happen here? Because, and let me say that I ask this because it appears to be a policy that's evolved kind of back and forth, if you will. You say that it has not changed since the statement by the chairman of the board in May, and that is that you were going to get this job done, and you were going to stick with it until it it is done, and you you sent out to I think these were available at your gas stations and sent out to
credit card mailers yesterday.
And of course the last line is, we want you to know that we will not be satisfied until the cleanup is complete. And that's obviously the kind of assurances that we heard from you when we were in Alaska earlier this year. And it's those assurances that we asked Admiral Robbins to build on in terms of watching out for the public interest. Then along comes the Harrison memo, I guess as we'll call it for the purpose of this hearing, which suggests, in fact, that Exxon is now going to take a series of unilateral steps, that the consultative process that's just been described by Admiral Lusk is not going to take place, that we're not going to negotiate these points. The interesting thing is that that memo and your testimony in the Senate seem fairly consistent, especially when you look at both Senator Kerry and Senator Stevens trying to elicit from you whether or not you're going to come back in the spring. Now, the testimony that you have submitted to this committee suggests yet another change in that relationship between Exxon and the Coast Guard, which I would suggest goes back more to the original proposition, and that is
You suggest that in its role as the federal on-scene coordinator as specified in the National Contingency Plan, it is the Coast Guard that will decide what additional cleanup is required with Exxon's involvement. That starts to suggest that, once again, it's the Coast Guard that is going to be making these determinations, and then Exxon will have to decide, which I guess is obviously their right, whether they will or will not comply with the directions of the Coast Guard, which now sound like it's also been extended to this notion of the winter activities. Where are we?
There are an awful lot of subjects on the table, Mr. Chairman.
Well, no, the only subject is the relationship between Exxon and the Coast Guard.
Let me take the Harrison memo, if I could, because I think that's the source of a lot of confusion. And I speak to this in my written testimony to which you referred earlier. The July 19th memo written by Mr. Harrison, who's the head of our operations there in Valdez, was intended as a communication to his staff, his managers, in order to tell them what their position should be on the subjects that you've raised here in terms of demob, winter, and spring. He was trying to say to them, any discussions, negotiations on those matters is reserved to me and me only. I want you to keep your eye on the ball, which is cleaning up, treating the shoreline this summer. And those matters, because they're working daily, as you're certainly aware, with a large number of agencies, interfacing with the Coast Guard, interfacing with Mr. Kelso's organization. Now, admittedly, in retrospect, the wording in Mr. Harrison's memo was unfortunate. And he would be the first to say that were he here. But I think we need to realize the conditions under which that man is working up there. It's a very big job. He's got a very large organization. He doesn't take a lot of time to carefully word memos. But I would hope that my opening statement here in terms of Exxon's commitment, but more importantly, what we're doing every day in terms of the operation up there would say that we will follow through, as I said earlier, in terms of our commitment to get the job done right.
Stevens, that's a characterization of the Harrison memo, but the other interesting thing about the Harrison memo is it's rather explicit. And this is why it raises concerns with respect to, I think, to this committee and what we can expect down the road. Point number one, Exxon will select the demobilization dates for phases of the operations. And you say you will base those on Exxon will select, not in consultation with the Coast Guard. You also suggest that our discussions with federal or state agencies is for the purposes of keeping them informed and not for requesting approval. This starts to suggest that Exxon is putting together its plan for the purposes of demobilization in this case, in which at this stage at least was the full demobilization of all equipment, and that's how it's going to happen. Your written testimony for this morning suggests that's changed, that's now a consultative process. Which is it?
Mr. Chairman, let me speak to one additional subject you raised earlier, and that is my testimony before the Senate Commerce Committee last week. I see no conflict with anything I said before that group and what I'm submitting in my written testimony here. Now, with respect to Mr. Harrison's memorandum, there is no way I will sit here and defend the wording in that memorandum. Mr. Harrison,
they say in politics that this memorandum is inoperative?
Yes, in terms of the discussion, and Mr. Harrison did say earlier this week, in fact, that he was in active discussions on those subjects with the Coast Guard. Again, he was wanting to restrict the involvement of his managers on those subjects, recognizing and to ensure that they recognize that they were reserved to him and him only.
But again, I mean, the consistency, and I want to allow other members of the committee to ask questions, the consistency here between the Harrison memo and your testimony and the news releases on your testimony is that We do not intend to work on shoreline cleanup past mid-September. And that suggests that even if a decision is made, because let's not pretend like this is an area that becomes totally inoperative and because of the winter. It was chosen for a port because, in fact, it's fairly temperate compared to the rest of Alaska, and that there may be cleanup efforts that can go on. But the suggestion in the Harrison memo, in your testimony, and 10 times Senator Kerry asked you, and finally Senator Stevens had to break in and ask you, and the answer was, we will consult later. And the question was continuously, are you going to come back and engage in this cleanup again? And that question wasn't answered. That's a question that has to be answered for the public and for this committee and for others.
Both with Senator Kerry and Senator Stevens, we discussed a specific circumstance, described a couple of beaches, and I said, if that's the way the beach looks, we will be back.
Wonder if that's not the way the beach looks, now, but the Coast Guard wants you back.
Well, I agree with Admiral Lusk's comments earlier about the role of the Coast Guard.
Right. Tell you to clean up a beach come September.
Well,
and you say it doesn't look like the beach I described to Senator Kerry. And you don't want to do it.
Well,
then
as
we
I
kick
say,
into the second phase of the plan where this becomes a federal operation?
As I say in my written testimony, we look to the Coast Guard in its role as the federal on-scene coordinator, and we have been able, where we've had differences, and they haven't been that many or that major, we've been able to reconcile those differences to the end of getting on with the job. And I have no reason, based on a lot of experience through the past 3 or 4 months, to feel that will be any different this winter or next spring.
Mr. Stevens, is Exxon going to follow the directions of the Coast Guard and its role as the on-scene federal management next spring?
Well, I would have to say yes in terms of any reasonable request, any reasonable job that needs to be done. Yes, we will.
You know the first thing they teach in law school is how reasonable men differ.
Well, here again, I go back to our experiences over the past couple of months, and I'm not a lawyer, Mr. Chairman. We have been able to differ and reconcile and move ahead to get the job done. I have no reason to expect that will change in the future.
Let me go back to the first part of your answer. Your answer is yes, that you will follow the directives of the Coast Guard in the spring?
The Coast Guard will make a determination. We, along with Mr. Kelso's organization and other involved agencies, will have input into that decision. Again,
right.
We will follow through on any reasonable request that is made. There may be some things. Again, I can't sit here today absent some sort of a specific understanding, absent scientific studies, so forth and so on, and make a unequivocal sort of commitment. I think I would be naive to do that, recognizing the vast amount of scientific uncertainty and so on. But again,
so we should not be surprised if in the spring Exxon decides not to comply with
I would
either
take the
all
contrary.
Of or parts of
I would take
directed.
The contrary view. Based on everything that's happened in the last 3 months, I think you should be very surprised. Could
Mr.
I speak
Smith.
To the question of winter for just a moment?
Sure.
Could I show a chart, please, with respect to the work that is to be done in the winter and the shutdown date, if you will? We've got a statistical study underway to analyze the weather. We've done quite a bit of that. But it's not a matter of temperature, Mr. Chairman. It's not a matter of temperate. It's a matter of wind and wave conditions. And this is a chart which gives you a feel for the change in the weather as you come out of the summer months. We're showing wind speed in the three shaded colors on the chart, and the percent of time that wind speed is in excess of a given level. And you'll notice the sharp change from August to September. Now, these are month average data. They are admittedly 10 years of average data. And that's the detailed statistical studies that are underway currently. But we've got, as Admiral Lusk said a moment ago, about 10,000 vessels on the water. Most of these, the vast number of them, are that involve people are flat-bottom vessels. And with that sort of change in the wind conditions, and let's see the wave conditions on the next chart. Same sort of picture. We have real concerns about our ability to demobilize, not to work, to demobilize if we wait too late. And here, of course, we have the ultimate responsibility for the safe working conditions of those people. Again, many organizations have oversight. So it's based on these sort of data, ultimately based on the ongoing studies, that we have picked a date of mid-September in terms of the need to stop, to be demobilized, have the people and these vessels off of the water, and also, I should say, to have people off of exposed shorelines. Because if you look at the daily data through the month of September, you see that the last half of September, again, on average, is very much different than the first half. And that's why the date of mid-September, give or take, has been selected. It is not intended to be telegraphing any lessening of commitment, so forth and so on, to getting the job done. Now, with respect to the work through the winter, we are still, in some areas, in a build-up phase. Just even in the last week or two, we have been adding equipment and adding people in response to changing situation. It's only in the last few weeks that we've had any time or people to begin to work a plan of demobilization, although I can go back to documents, Coast Guard documents as well as Exxon documents in April, which were talking about a mid-September notional demobilization date because of the wind and wave conditions. I do not have today, we do not have today, a detailed demobilization plan, but many of the things that Mr. Kelso mentioned earlier in terms of the wintertime activities are clearly going to be in that plan. Clearly, we're going to be there with an organization, when I say there, in Alaska, where we can get access to Prince William Sound, access to the greater Gulf of Alaska area, the Kenai Peninsula, Cook Inlet area. We're going to be doing aerial surveillance of the water, aerial surveillance of the shorelines. We'll certainly be doing monitoring of the treated and impacted shorelines to see what, if anything, is changing. If there is moose still moving around, we'll be monitoring that both aerially and on the shorelines. We're going to be doing a lot of scientific investigation in the water and on the shorelines, all in preparation for next spring. I would guess, and here again, I'm getting ahead of the work by my operations and technical people, but some preliminary numbers would say that we'll probably have a total organization in the range of 200 people. What we will not have, again, as I said a moment ago, through the course of the wintertime storm period, is people out on the water or trying to work on exposed shorelines, because we do not feel that can be done safely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a fascinating discussion, I guess, to see how people and events put you in different places. I'm sure you wouldn't, none of you would like to have been here, nor would you have liked to have been in the Sound when that boat hit the rock. But I'm curious now, under the law, the way things are stated, who is in charge? The Coast Guard is in charge? Or is the state of Alaska in charge? Or
Coast Guard is in charge.
Coast Guard is in charge. Does the state have any disagreement with what the Coast Guard is directing in the operations?
Coast Guard is directing the conduct of the recovery operations. State law still applies, however, for example, with respect to contamination of shoreline. But we have no problem working with the Coast Guard.
You have no problem working with Exxon? Are you happy with what has been in the directions of the Coast Guard so far? Are you happy with what they are trying to do?
We have had a cooperative relationship with the Exxon staff in the field. We have had concerns about what we've heard from Exxon's upper levels as far as how they plan to proceed. We're not fully satisfied, certainly now, there's still a great deal of ambiguity, because the implication has been that the spiller, Exxon, still is going to reserve the decision on whether to carry out the direction from Coast Guard or from the state as far as wrapping up the work that needs to be done.
Kind of interested, Admiral, what kind of relationship is Exxon in with you? Is it a mother may I, or is it an advisory that I am going to do something? I mean, do they ask your permission, like when the winds get too high, is the Coast Guard in the position where they say, wait a minute, we don't want you to have the people out there because it's too dangerous?
Well, with regard to safety, I guess safety is kind of bred into us, and so our people would probably be making suggestions like that. But I've heard absolutely nothing that suggests that they're not being attentive.
Okay, but I'm just trying to get a feel for if in fact there were an accident because the winds were high and you had cautioned against going out, and you end up in a rescue situation with workers. How's that play out?
Well, essentially, Exxon makes proposals to the Federal On-Scene Coordinator. And like I say, that poor chap has a number of advisors, possibly at times more than he wishes he had.
But I was just kind of curious about the legal relationship. If you have rules for the operation up there? In other words, if you get over 20 knots, do you bring the boats back in, or do you...
I don't know of any rules that have been set like that, sir, because there's so many different types of equipment. Okay. Certainly some things can be done in bad weather and others can't.
I might think that you might... promulgate something like that, because at a certain point in here, if you were going to get a window of opportunity to stay till the third week in September or something else, I understand that Exxon is sort of committed to doing whatever they can. But if in fact you had you'd had a drop dead date rather than look at the weather and see what kind of a window you have there.
I think Vice Admiral Robbins is looking at a phase down of those pieces of equipment that should be taken out. Exxon would propose, and we would agree or not agree, and then there would probably be a lot of more portable equipment, shall we say, more easily deployed, more easily taken out, that might well stay longer.
Are you learning quite a bit about the technology involved, and still are adding new experimental effort to try?
We certainly are. We're learning that much of the equipment that we thought would handle most any spill doesn't handle most any spill. We're learning that we've once again found a type of oil we don't know how to cope with, don't have the technology to cope with properly. We're wishing we had more money that we'd spent on research and development in recent years. We've been cutting back. We wish we'd spent more. We're learning a lot.
There are a lot of people on site. It's quite an effort just to keep that organized and headed in the right direction. Are you still seeing people added, or are more people needed?
Mr. Smith, it's an interesting thing. I don't think we or anyone else in America will ever be satisfied with a level of effort, unless the level of effort puts the oil back in the tanker within seconds of it having been released.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those kind of things where people say, why don't you have more people? There comes a limit.
Yeah.
You know, we're out there, we're absolutely stretching almost to the point of breaking the support capability in some of those areas. When you start talking about 10,000 people on some of those beaches, now how many people can you put in Prince William Sound? There's a limit to these.
What kind of safety record do you have, and does Exxon have in this effort in the last 4 or 5 months, whatever?
Sir, there have been injuries. I don't know. There was one death. I don't have those figures on at my fingertips.
Mr. Stevens, do you have?
Yes, I do. The one death was tragic and unfortunate. An individual on a vessel, contrary to explicit instructions, climbed in a dumbwaiter, I believe it was a Navy vessel, in fact, to move from one floor to the other, and was crushed.
Wow.
And the dumbwaiter, of course, was just intended to carry food and material up and down. That's been the only death. But I have some statistics before me. The workforce up there, this is a contract and the Exxon people, have worked over 11.5 million man hours to date, and we're averaging less than 30 recordable OSHA injuries per million man hours. And that compares to about 100 per million man hours for U.S. non-resident construction as a whole.
versus heavy construction. We're again less than 30, and heavy construction contractors, last year we have data 1987, are about 38. And with respect to disabling injuries, these are the more serious injuries, the workforce record in the Sound is about 14.5 per million man hours. And again, heavy construction contractors in 1987 were about 16.5. So the safety record is something that has concerned us since day one. We've done an extensive amount of training, and I should say we've had some help and advice from NIOSH, from OSHA, from the state labor or department, and so on. We're not satisfied with any recordable injuries, with any disabling accidents, but we're working the problem, and the record is good.
In looking at what's occurred here, obviously you've had some communication differences with this Harrison memo and some of these other things. I guess all of us are concerned that that you have a continuing commitment, and the memo was not quite right, but you do still intend to see this cleaned up to the best of the technical ability of the society at this point, I guess. Is that
we
fair?
We still intend to see the job done, yes.
And
we
if
will
it takes
certainly
next summer or the summer after that, are you commit? I mean, I don't want to get you to commit, but in other words, you're looking for the best possible cleanup of these beaches within the technical constraints of what the society knows about.
Congressman, don't let me give the impression I'm trying to split words with you. But we are already, in some quarters, being criticized for over-cleaning, over-pressuring beaches. And I think as time goes on.
Now, whose responsibility is that? In other words, are you taking this? Okay. I'm back to the
Coast
Guard.
Can I see the organization chart? And this responds to one of your earlier questions.
Okay, I'm interested. You know, are you reacting to the Coast Guard, or are you acting and then they're giving advice and consent?
Turn it around for just a minute, Paul. Let me make another point before they start focusing on the picture. I'm looking at a memo here that was written on April 20th. Once the federal on-scene commander got on the scene and set up an organization. And this was sent to the state, to Exxon, to a large number of organizations up there. And the subject was, quote, organizational structure of the cleanup effort for the Exxon Valdez oil spill, end quote. And point three in his summary memo introducing about a 10-page document. And here again, I quote, I expect advice from all interested parties through the structure I set forth in the attached, and I'll show you that in a moment. I would like to make it very clear, I, as the on-scene coordinator, make the final decisions as to what Exxon does to clean up this spill. There can be only one boss, and I have that responsibility. Now, this was April 20th, Mr. Chairman, about 3-plus weeks after the accident occurred. And believe me, those intervening 3-plus weeks made the point very clear to us that if everybody is in charge, nobody is in charge, and as a consequence, nothing happens. And I would submit that if someone had been in charge that Good Friday, that possibly we would have been able, we believe, we would have been able to mitigate the impact on the shorelines in Prince William Sound. But again, because everybody was in charge, timely decisions were not made, and steps which we feel very strongly should have happened were not taken. Now, let me come to the organization chart. This is the organization chart that was referred to in that comment I read you from Admiral Robbins' memo. And here you see at the bottom of the chart, the federal on-scene coordinator, Admiral Robbins. And you look back to the top of the chart, and you see how the decisions are made through the process, beginning with advisory functions from the Interagency Shoreline Advisory Committee. That includes the state, many state agencies, federal agencies, and so on. That is input into the priority setting, and you notice down toward the bottom again, or in the middle rather, that after the plan is developed by Exxon, and reviewed with the Coast Guard. Again, that committee has an input into the process. The FOSC, F-O-S-C, approves it. And then there can be adjustments as the work goes on in response to the advent of fishing seasons, native needs, hunting, so forth and so on. And here again, all of the involved agencies on the scene, including the state agencies, have an input, no, to the right, Paul, advice, have an input into the federal on-scene coordinator at that point. So the idea that, or the thought, the thrust of any comment that Exxon has ever been able to do anything unilaterally or will in the future with the sort of organizational structure under the legal framework of the Clean Water Act, National Contingency Plan, and this sort of organization, you know, that's just not the way it has been happening or will happening. There are many, many agencies who need to have an input here and who do.
But clearly, with this, if the gentleman will yield, clearly within the law, as Adam Lusk has pointed out, Exxon can opt out of that process, and this can become a federal cleanup, and we can send you the bill and argue over the bill and whose responsibility. Is that not correct?
I'm not a lawyer again. That's my understanding of the law. And we could have done that on Good Friday, March
Absolutely.
The 24th. What did we do, Mr. Chairman?
No question.
We said we're responsible. We accept the obligation that comes with that responsibility, and we stepped up, and we've been there ever since, and we intend to stay.
Good.
One further question. Admiral, how are you doing money-wise? Are you getting enough money to handle the problem that you need because of your budget constraints and also R&D money? We talked about this the other day in another hearing.
Well, certainly, sir, we don't have any surplus money. In general, I might say that right now we have hundreds of authorized billets that aren't filled because we don't have enough money to pay the salary. So we're not flush. As far as the 311K fund, which is that fund which is provided by the Clean Water Act, out of which we can take expenses for federalization should that become necessary. That fund has never had more than $25 million in it. At the present time, it has about $4.6 million. The dire emergency supplemental, which was passed within the last few weeks, did indicate that should it be necessary to take money out of the 311K fund in excess of the funds that were in it, that we could have access to our operating expense money. Well, it's the operating expense money that we're so short of that's causing us to have no people available. So I don't know what would happen. But in any event, we don't have a lot of money should there be another spill that we have to federalize.
I appreciate your answer. I just wanted for the record. Thank you very much.
Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have no questions and maybe a couple of comments. You said that Exxon was learning from this experience with the Harrison message, the memo. Among other things, have you studied and defined your process for getting the necessary memos out?
Certainly, what was already a recognized fact, Congressman, and that is that operation up there is in a glass house, has been reaffirmed by our experiences with respect to that memo. And I am sure, and in fact I can refer to a late evening phone call from Valdez yesterday evening, I am sure that a lot more care and wording in memos written will be true in the future. But here again,
why? Because somebody is trying to interpret the advice, the content of the Harrison memo, to summarize it. To me, it came across as these are timeless words in a memo. For safety and operational reasons, Exxon will conduct no cleanup operations during the winter. And on point number three, our only commitment for the spring of 1990 is to survey the shorelines. What you've said here to Alaska and to the people of the country, to me, is we've been here, we came, we saw, we fouled your beaches, that we're going home, goodbye, and have a nice day. That's the way that memo comes across.
Clearly it's subject to misinterpretation, and it was intended, again, not as a communication to the Coast Guard, or certainly not to the Alaskans or anyone else.
Ms.
Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just change the focus a little bit, it's my understanding that the salmon industry, the fishing industry in Alaska, is about a $400 million a year industry, and that the salmon portion of that, particularly those fish that are taken with the Kodiak fleet, is just about a wash this year. It's just about non-existent. Is that correct, Mr. Kelso?
In the areas affected by the spill, the salmon season has been really hit hard.
Well, my question then is for Mr. Stevens, and that is, what role is Exxon taking with the fishing fleet that, as I understand, many boats are in jeopardy of being lost? People rely on the fishing to make the payments in the boats, and without the fish, they're simply not going to do it. Could you tell us your role in that?
Within days after the spill, we set up our first claims office in Valdez, and then within a week in Cordova, and the last count I had, we had claims offices in 8 towns, villages in the impacted area, including Kodiak, Homer, Kenai, Seward, so forth. Well, Anchorage and Valdez and Cordova, I may have omitted one.
What do you actually do in the claims office when a person comes in who's about to lose the boat? That's what I want to know.
We're working on an advance basis where there is evidence of damage, and as the seasons have been closed and it's clear they're not going to open, an advance system has been put in place. We're not requiring